Let's turn together to the book of Hebrews chapter 2. Last week as we were looking at this, you know, we hit a passage that's pretty serious stuff. It was kind of a heavy text to a degree. And, you know, it was given the exhortation that we need to cling to hold fast to all that we have been, all that's been revealed to us in Jesus Christ, and hold to that alone and not begin to embrace some other things. Well, that was almost like a parenthesis in what the writer of Hebrews has been addressing here in chapter 1, and he's going to continue in chapter 2. Because up to this point, he's been talking about the greatness and the majesty of Christ, and specifically how he's greater than what any angel is and what any angel would reveal. Well, he's going to pick that up again here in chapter 2. And he's going to show us a couple of things. First, he's going to show us what only Jesus could accomplish. And he's going to show us that Jesus could only accomplish these things as a man, a human being. So this week, you know, and for the next couple, this is part one of three parts as we look at this text and all that we discover in that. But we're going to leave the somber tones and look at this glorious revelation of Jesus. It's my privilege today, hopefully, and this is my prayer, that we can stir up your religious affections for Jesus. That you not only know in your head, but that you feel it in your heart. Because if all you do is you know it in your head, you just go, great, Jack, I got it. You look at your wife and says, hey, that was great. Now, what's for lunch? And then you're moving on to something else. No, my prayer is this sticks with you on Thursday morning, on Saturday night. That you keep coming back to these truths and they move you. So one of the issues I think that we have is a lot of times what the people that were being addressed here from the book of Hebrews had. Jesus is a man. Now we, if we're candid, we like a lot of the supernatural, the extreme things. Those are the things that really fascinate us. And when we think of Jesus, we think, yeah, man, I'd love to see him in his transfiguration. Well, that would be awesome. Or to be there at the feeding of the 5,000, see that incredible thing happen. But, you know, you want to talk to me about Jesus being a human, being a man, well, that's all right, you know. I mean, but the idea that the divine, the sovereign, would come down to be a plain, ordinary human often doesn't sound all that exciting to us. We like to see things go up, not necessarily come down. And I wonder if part of the reason that these people who this writer is addressing were moving towards a desire of wanting this, you know, feeling of spiritual mysticism, or maybe they were wanting to go through some sort of spiritual acts because the idea of Jesus as a man just wasn't really feeling it. You know, they weren't feeling it to the same degree. And sometimes I think we get more enamored in the same way. With things that probably demonstrate some form of a spirituality or a mysticism in an otherworldliness fashion, other than merely Jesus' humanity. But his humanity, ladies and gentlemen, it is absolutely essential for God's plan, for our well-being, and for God's glory. He had to become a man. And the writer of Hebrews is going to show you eight reasons why. We're not covering all eight today. We're going to break it up over a three-week period. But today we're going to examine why Jesus became a man, and we're not going to stop there. We're going to say, now, why does that matter so much? Why should I care? How does that impact me and in my life? So Hebrews chapter 2, beginning in verse 5, let's pick back up here with this notion that Jesus is greater than any angel. Look what he says. For he, meaning God, did not put the world to come about which we are speaking under the control of angels. Instead, someone testified somewhere, and you know, here he's going to pick up with Psalm 8, the one that Nate read to you here a few minutes ago in the worship set. And he refers to it vaguely, because remember, when this is being written, they don't have chapter and verse divisions. Okay, so he's basically, this is his way of saying, let's go to the scriptures. And then he's going to do something with you. He's going to give you good, solid exegesis of a scripture. What does that mean? It means he's going to go to the Old Testament, Psalm 8, and he's going to examine it first, and he's going to say, what did that text mean to anybody looking on? In that day, in this day, any era of history, what did it mean within its context and who it was addressing? Then he's going to look at it a second time, and he's going to take out the lenses of Jesus Christ and put them on our eyes, And then we're going to look and see what this thing has to say and how it reveals to us a prophecy of who Jesus is and what it is that he had to do. So let's take a look at it, all right? Keep going. He asked this question. What is man that you think of him? Or the son of man that you care for him? Now the psalmist is asking the question that often many of us ask. When it comes to man, what is our purpose as men, as humanity? What is the purpose? Philosophers are asking that all the time. We ask that question, why am I here? What is the purpose? Well, he answers it. You made him lower than the angels for a little while. You crowned him with glory and honor, and you put all things under his control. So what he's saying here is man is a little lower than angels when you talk about the time of creation and even our destiny. Because you think about it, an angel isn't moving towards a greater destiny. What an angel will encounter in the future is very much what he's encountered in the past. Their destiny doesn't go on an upward trajectory like ours does. We start out a little lower than angels. Next, we're going to find, and as time progresses, we're going to be elevated higher and above angels. So man is destined to be crowned with glory and honor. There's a glory and honor that God has given us. And part of this is that we are to rule over creation. And our rule over the creation has a purpose. And that is to take all that is before us and put it under the dominion and the authority of God. That's what we're to do. You don't have to turn there, and I don't have for the screen, but let me read you from Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 through 28, because this is going to describe what I'm talking about. It says this, God said, let us make humankind in our image, after our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the cattle and over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move on the earth. And God created humankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female. He created them, and God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and every creature that moves on the ground. So as creator, God is sovereign over his creation. And here's what he said. He said, now I have all of this, man, I want you to rule over it. I'm giving that charge and that authority over to you. And so this is what man as man is to do, to take all of that and put it under the administration and the rule of God. The Puritans had a great term for that. They said man is God's vice regent. By vice, we mean like a deputy. You've got the vice president as opposed to the president. And the president can give some things to the vice president to do. That's his role. He's that deputy. But he calls him the vice regent, from where we get the word regal or kingly. So this is the deputy to the king. That's what man is. And that's what our task is, to take that role as the deputy to the king and take these things and put them under the subjugation of God. But even though we've been given this honor, how are we doing as humanity? How are we doing in taking the world and putting it under this authority and under submission to God? You know, if humanity got a progress report, we had to go, you know, sit before him. He's going to give us our annual review. What do you think he's going to say? What's God going to do? We're going in nervous. We're going to get the pink slip. Because there's a lot of things, you know, there's things that have gone on that are good, but there's a lot of problems out there too. And while our purpose has not been terminated, one of the things we also know is it has not yet been realized by us. We've not done it. And that's why verse 8 is going to continue. Follow along with me here. For when he, meaning God, for when God put all things under man's control, he left nothing outside of man's control. And at present, we do not yet see all things under man's control. So God's purposes are unchanged and unchangeable. They're still there, but they've not been realized. They've not been accomplished by us. Now, why is that? Well, let me tell you why. I'll tell you something I learned in seminary. I think I've shared with you before. I went to Dallas Theological Seminary, where we learned many wise and great things. And one of the great and wise things that we're taught is that one comes before three. Soak that in, will you? All right. Yeah, that's it. One comes before three. And I'm talking about Genesis chapter 1, occurs before Genesis chapter 3. See, it's in Genesis chapter 1 that man is created and man is given this role. He's given this responsibility and this opportunity to exalt God in this way. The problem that we have is that chapter 3 follows not too long afterwards. And it's in chapter 3 that man, specifically in Adam, didn't do it. We fell and we chose instead to go our own way. And we've had problems ever since. And as Adam went, so go we. I'm not sure about the grammar on that, but you know, hang in there with me. As Adam went, we're going in the same direction. We are no different. We're still doing that. Now, fallen humanity, let's face it, we've worked hard at subjugating nature, that's for sure. There's a lot of things that we've done, and a lot of things we've done great. See also smallpox, right? Used to go into a town, and it would wipe it out. And now we've basically, potentially, wiped out smallpox. Or I could talk about polio. You old people, don't take offense at it, but you old people, you remember when someone used said the term polio, and that struck fear in your hearts. And now, good night, a lot of our young people don't even know what polio is or what it was. And we've had this ability to begin to take these things and to make them better, to rule. Technological developments, it's phenomenal. And I've spoken of dentistry before. Going to the dentist is not like it used to be. You know, I remember it used to be, it was extreme pain. Now, the only thing that's painful is the bill that you're going to get afterwards. And it's heavy. But there's a reason why. It's because it's so much better. That technological development is great. It's that bringing things under subjugation and rule. Or I could talk about, you know, think about, we put a man on the moon, we put satellites or devices on Mars that can speak back to us and communicate to us and show us things. We've got stuff that's gone outside of our solar system and can communicate back with us and pass these things on and show us things. So it's pretty incredible some of the things that man has been able to do in accomplishing this. And yet, how are we doing morally as humanity? How are we doing there? We got a big problem there. We've not done a good job of putting these kinds of things under God's control. In fact, if anything, we've perverted a lot of our purposes. Just think, we can take germs, we can take atoms and generate weapons of mass destruction. We can take those devices and we can make an area uninhabitable for thousands of years if we decide to. We've got technological devices like the internet and all the great things that the internet can do, but what is it that generally we find more advertisers are working in and through? It's through pornography, the perversion of sex, enslaving of people through those kinds of things. Both the ones that are sending the images, but those who are also receiving the images as well. And what I'm saying about humanity, I could say about us as individuals too, right? We've all got these areas where we've not done. We've not got the domain. We've not brought under God's control what it is that we should have. Whether you want to talk about your job, you want to talk about your home. Some of you do want to talk about the government. All the problems we got there and how we'd love to get that subjugated, right? But I'll tell you something. The older I get, the more I realize how little control we actually have. It's not that much. It's very illusory, you know, as you're younger. It's just, you think, oh, yeah, I can commandeer and take domain and all these kinds of things. And then the years have a way of sort of showing you, no, you can't. Little bitty things can wreck and ruin all that. And on top of that, there's a big difference between ruling over something and bringing something under the domain and control of God in there. Those are very different. And often just ruling something we can't even do, and it's hard. And so here's how we do it. You want to rule something, you want to get domain, this is what you're going to do. You're going to get mean. You're going to get angry, you're going to get vicious, you're going to get threatening, and you're going to start forcing people and things to come under your control and your rule and your oversight. And so, as individuals, we have failed. Happy Valentine's Day. Let's look at Psalm 8 a second time with the writer of Hebrews. Only this time, let's take our lenses of Jesus. Let's put them on. How does Jesus fulfill the prophecy? In verse 9, we're going to get the contrast of Adam, humanity's failure, and Jesus, the Son of Man. Look what he says. But we see Jesus, who was made lower than the angels for a little while. Meaning, here's God, who also became man. And now today, he is now crowned with glory and honor. Remember what we saw back in verse 7? God's given glory and honor to man in this role, but we haven't fulfilled it. And now Jesus wears this glory and this honor. And what man has failed to do, Jesus has in fact accomplished. He's become flesh. And he's identified with us in the human race. And he alone is able to fulfill the original purpose by which man was supposed to fulfill in service to God. From Genesis 1. So, you type A's, all right, in your bulletin there. I gave you a little outline that you can follow. Or if those of you in the life groups that you can, anchor points that you can follow as you bring in the discussion this week. Let me give you the first point, what we just looked at here. And that is, Jesus had to come as a man to fulfill man's purpose. Because we didn't do it. And we couldn't do it. How did Jesus fulfill man's purpose? The writer tells you. Keep reading. Because he suffered death. Whoa. Now, if you've checked out with me so far, all right, I'm going to come back here. Come back with me. You know, you think about Valentine's or what's going to happen later or last night's movie. Put that out. Come back, because these are deep waters. But this is key to understanding something very significant about Jesus and even about ourselves. He suffered death, and that's how we find him achieving this glory and honor. Jesus' death, what occurred? When he died, what we learn is he chose to be obedient when Adam chose not to be obedient. That's the issue. Stands in stark contrast to Adam and Adam's disobedience. Adam forsook the administrative authority that God had given him and rebelled, chose to go his own way, use his own wisdom, use the wisdom of the serpent, and reject what it is that God had. And as a result, Adam fell into disgrace and death. Those are the consequences that came. But now through Jesus' obedience, and his obedience even to the point of death, he has accomplished God's will. That's the contrast. His death did what God wanted and what God would accomplish. And now he can bring the world under the domain, under the control of God. That's what he's done. And that is what brings Jesus the glory and honor that is due his name and that we see here in this passage. It's good, meaty stuff. So, sweetheart, what are we having for lunch? No, you got to go beyond the good, meaty stuff. Why does this make any difference to you at all? It matters for this reason. Because, friend, you can't accomplish the purpose that God ordained for you to do in and of yourself. You can't do it. And you have to rest in the fact that Jesus has done it for you. He was the vice regent that would accomplish what these vice regents could not. We never succeeded until the God-man, Jesus Christ, came. And that's the new Adam that we can put our faith and our trust in. Here's a scenario maybe that'll help bring some understanding of what does that mean for us in daily life. Years ago, we had all these people over, you know, these pilgrims over in Europe, and they felt the religious persecution, so they came across the ocean, they came to America, and they began to set up their colonies and the beachheads and so forth, and, you know, they're up and down the East Coast. And so I liken it to this. After that's occurred, now you find, hey, you know what? We got to go over there. We got to go live so that we can live under the purposes that God has for us and not live under these other constraints. So you get in your boat and you start going over there. But here's what you don't do. You don't go over there to start another port. You're not going there to go into some new beachhead and establish that. You're going over to what has already been established for you to now live in it and to enjoy it. And to contribute to it. But you weren't the one generating it. Jesus was our trailblazer. And he's the one that has established what God wanted. And now what? Now you and I get to enjoy the fullness of what it is that he's created. And it matters, and I'm talking to Christians right now. If you've believed and trusted in Jesus Christ, why does it matter? It matters because if you don't embrace that truth, friend, you're going to try to build your own beachhead and do your own towns and your own colonies by the power of your flesh, and you are not going to succeed because you can't. You can't do it. We've had 2,000 years since Christ, and then before that, you know, 2,000 years before that, no one has done it. Why do you think you're going to be able to? You can't. But Christ has. And if you try to do it, I'll tell you what you're going to do. You're going to get real mean. You're going to get ugly and forceful. Y'all ever heard of a phenomenon in our culture called the tiger mom? What is that? That's that woman who says, this child is going to establish this domain and conquer. And I'm going to make sure they do it. And they are not very fun people to be around, are they? And on top of that, that child cannot accomplish everything that that tiger mom wants that child to accomplish. Some of you, you've encountered this at work. Maybe some of you, you struggle with this, being this, with an employer who makes life miserable for everybody because you're going to get that control and you're going to establish everything just like it's supposed to be, whether it's for God or maybe it's just for your purposes. And now everybody comes into work wondering, is this my last day? You know, am I going to make the fatal mistake and thus find myself out on the street? Not fun. Some of you dads, this is the way you're running your house. You're struggling with it. And it's your anger that's going to bring things under control. And life is actually not too bad until about 5:30 to 7:30, that time when you walk in the door and the cloud comes over and everyone's walking on eggshells. But you're going to have that control. You're going to get it done. And you're not. In fact, the harder you try, the more you're going to fail, and you're going to be characterized by this. One of two things. You're going to be characterized by anger, first of all. That's what's going to happen. Or, when you realize your anger doesn't work, your anger is going to turn inward. We call that depression. Anger that has gone inward, and you're going to walk into despair because you're realizing, I can't do it. What do you do? You come into the township, into the city that Jesus has already established. And our call is to walk in faithfulness. You know what the problem is? That's not enough for us. Control means we're going to manage the outcome. We're going to make it happen. And that's where you'll never find peace. And God hasn't called you and I to manage the outcomes. Ultimately, that's what Jesus has done. You can't manage the outcomes. And we trust him. And if you try to, I'll promise you, you're going to go to bitterness, you're going to go to anger, or you're going to go to depression. Any one of those three. That'll be your path. What do you need to do? When you're frustrated at the outcome, don't try to manage it. Go to the cross. Go to the empty tomb. Remember that Jesus is the one who's going to bring about the ultimate outcomes because he's the one who's fulfilled all that God wants, all his ultimate purposes. And now you just surrender and submit yourself to be faithful with what God has given you and let him manage those outcomes. You just obey and leave the results to him. Leave them to him. And by the way, are we going to see all the results today like we want? No way. No, you're not. That, incidentally, is why Jesus has to come back. He has ushered in this period where this is beginning and this is starting. But it hasn't come to its fruition, but it will. And when he comes in his second coming, what do we discover? The lion is going to lay down with the lamb and is not going to eat him. And a child can sit there and play with an adder, a poisonous snake, and is not going to get bit. Because Jesus will have established that full subjugation. We'll see this in its fullness when he returns. But until then, it has started. So you sail your little boat into your port, into your township, and you live what Jesus has already started. And I think, you know, ultimately that's where this takes a lot of us. So if he's done everything, what does that leave me? You know, what am I supposed to do until he comes back? What's the divine purpose today? Here's your answer. You bring him glory. That's what you do. And you'll do it as you walk faithfully in faith in Christ alone. And you're not hanging to all these other things. And practically, I'll tell you two ways this will work out. First thing that's going to work out for you is in your prayer life. Because over and over again, you're going to keep coming back to God in your prayers. And you're going to go, God, I'm getting frustrated because I'm trying to put things under your subjugation, your authority, and your control. And it's not working. I need you to take it over. I need you to manage the outcomes. And you're going to be surrendering that over and over and over again. You're going to be surrendering those children. You're going to be faithful with them, but you're going to surrender them to God. And he's going to have to manage the outcomes ultimately in their life. And you're going to take that ministry and you're going to surrender that to him. You know, and you're trying to make it work and trying to make these things happen, surrender it to him. And he's going to be the one to manage the end result, because ultimately that's what Jesus does. The other thing it'll do practically is it's going to move you a little bit closer to your church and the work of your church, because our divine purpose is ultimately accomplished and realized in the person of Jesus Christ. And it's the church where God is going to accomplish his purposes. It's in and through the church that he's going to accomplish that. So what does that mean? It means as you're participating in his body and going with the new commission that we have, making disciples, which ultimately what is that? It's just pointing to Jesus and say, look at the glories that exist in him. You'll want to follow him. That's ultimately what we wind up doing. And you will find yourself aligning more and being a part of that commission today and finding your purpose, not in what you do, but in what Jesus has done. Do y'all see why the incarnation, that God becoming flesh, is so important to us? He had to fulfill our purposes. And ultimately, we'll find our glory and honor because we ride his coattails. That's where we'll find it. That's just the first point. We got another one. How long? It's taking me 30 minutes to get there. You can do another 30, right? No problem. You get a Valentine's lunch, they'll hold it for you. Trust me. No, I got another one. I'll go through it quickly here for you. Let's look at the second reason why it's so important that Jesus would come in the form of a human. He would come as a man. It's written there in the text. He became man so that by God's grace, he would experience death on behalf of everyone. See, the second point, Jesus had to become a man to taste death for us. Why is that important? Because if we're a people who have sinned, then we incur the penalty of sin. And that's death. And it's not just a physical death. And as our lives get older and they start becoming more decrepit, we are seeing the results, aren't we? Pastor Rich and I were out this week and we were, you know, visiting some folks that are elderly and just kind of commenting how we've seen over time, you know, their spirit is going strong, but their bodies are just going down exponentially. And it was the reminder of the effects of sin. And it's going to culminate in a physical death one day. But for a lot of humanity, that opens the door then not only to the physical death, but to the spiritual death as well. And ultimately, this is what death is, at least our physical one. It is a balloon payment for sin. Romans 3:23, the wages of sin is death. And if sin's wages aren't paid adequately, then there's no being with God. You can't do it. But if we have Jesus, who has no sin of his own, then what do we know? If he has no sin, he can be with God. But there's a problem with a guy that has no sin. You know what it is? Now, this is going to blow your mind. If Jesus has no sin, and the wages of sin is death, then Jesus cannot physically die. That's a problem. Unless he takes the penalty or somebody else's sin upon himself. And when he does that, then he can die. And this is one of the reasons why it's so important that Jesus tasted death for us, because it is a proof to us that the sinless one really did take my sin. Because if he didn't, he would still be right here having never undergone a cross. But because he has died, I know he was cloaked in sin. And it was mine. And it was yours. And he's the one who's tasted it. And because he's tasted it, folks, we now can go into our death and not be afraid. Everybody fears death to some degree. But you don't have to fear it. Why? Because he's tasted it and he said, now that you can go through it and know something, I've taken care of everything for you. And I can tell you what you're going to experience on the backside. You're going to walk across the rivers of death to walk into eternal life because you've taken the boat of Jesus and you've rested in him. And he's the one that's carried you there. You see why it's so important that he, the man, would taste death? We know our sin is taken care of. It was placed upon him. And he's the trailblazer. I now know that when I go through my death, what God has for me on the backside, because he's taken care of it. He knows. I've shared this illustration with you before. I'm going to share it again. You watch movies a second time, right? Third time, fourth time. How many times have you seen Lord of the Rings? Case, point made. Illustration. Two young men gone into battle, knew each other very well. As they're sitting in the foxhole, the assault starts coming. One of them gets up, gets in on the charge. As he's charging to going towards the enemy, he gets cut down by enemy fire and he's dropped, but he's not yet dead. And his cries and his moans, his movement is seen. And it was his friend that jumped up and says, I gotta go get him. And no sooner did he jump up to go get his friend, his commanding officer grabs him by the shoulder, pulls him back and says, no, you can't do it. If you do it, you risk everything, and what's more, I can see his injuries. He's not going to live. Don't risk it. As soon as the commanding officer took his arm off the man's shoulder, he paused for 1 second, jumped up, went out in the midst of the fire, ran all the way, and got to his friend. Spent a couple of minutes there with him while everything's going on, bullets flying, shells bursting. Grabs his friend, drags him back all the way to the line. When he brings him back, the man was dead. His friend was gone. And the commanding officer chided him. You put yourself at risk to go out there when I told you there was nothing to be gained. He was dead. And the man said, no. No, there was something to be gained, because when I got there, he was still alive. And he told me, I knew you would come. And though my friend had to die, he didn't have to die alone. I was there with him. Friends, Jesus made it a point that you wouldn't be alone. He's tasted death for you. He's been there. And as a result, you won't die alone. And God has a plan for you on the other side. He has a plan for you on this side. You need not fear death. And that's just 2 out of 8. It was important that Jesus became a man. We needed the God-man, one who could fulfill the role that we could not fill, and one who could taste death and emerge from death victoriously and give us the hope and the promise of what we face and what we'll find with God. Would you bow with me?